If you get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the Digicam icon. You'll find this one now right underneath the story on the Mars hole. It's the Digicam icon. You will see what someone sent me about a week or so ago, what could be hair of a Bigfoot. Now, we're going to send this on to cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman, and hopefully Lauren can get this analyzed. We can find out exactly what this is. We have the hair in our possession right now, but if you want to take a look at the picture of what the hair looks like, then you get up to the Digicam icon right there at coasttocoastam.com. Stand by now for High Adventure in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Peter von Puttkamer has been writing, directing, producing international award-winning films here in the United States and in Canada for more than the last 25 years. His company is Gryphon Productions. It has created documentaries for the Learning Channel, Animal Planet, Discovery Channel, and other specialty channels. His fascination with indigenous peoples, anthropology, archaeology, mythology, music, and wildlife has led to work around the world, incredible work. Peter has climbed through ancient caves used for human sacrifice in Mexico, filmed then eaten 12-inch tarantulas with Venezuelan blowgun hunters, filmed sacred mask rituals and dances of North American natives, chased caribou herds on the Arctic Circle, and even joined a hunt for Bigfoot. He's our guest now on Coast to Coast. Peter, you do tremendous work.
Hi there. Thank you very much. It's a very exciting life. That's true.
Hey, when you have time, get up to our website with the Digicam icon, which you'll find there, and take a look at what could be hair of Bigfoot. You might be interested in that.
Yeah, I heard that earlier. I'm interested, and Lauren Coleman's a friend of mine, and be interesting to see what he has to say.
Hey, tell us a little bit about some of your work.
Well, for the last, you heard I've been doing this for over 20 years, and a lot of my work started working with indigenous peoples, Native Americans, and their ceremonies and mask traditions and things, and that really got me into looking initially at Bigfoot in 1998-99 as something, you know, that had a really interesting backstory to it. I mean, when you've got Native people talking about this creature and representing it in their dances and in their culture for hundreds and hundreds of years, it seems to me that they probably know something that we don't about a big critter being out there. So I did a film called Sasquatch Odyssey, The Hunt for Bigfoot, and it's really it's really been popular, and it's one that looks at the culture and the original Bigfoot hunters, people like Rene DeHinden and Peter Byrne and Dr. Grover Krantz, John Green.
Some of the kings of the Bigfoot search.
Yeah, it's the only film with all four of them in it, and you really get an insight into why they spend a lifetime searching for this creature.
Well, and when you talk about these ancient cultures and ancient people who include this in their mythology, include it in their work and their dances, there's got to be something to it.
Yep, and probably never, I can talk to you a little bit more about my other work, but in the current production in Beyond Invention, there's actually another creature that, white people have called Cadbrosaurus, and it's a sea serpent-like creature in the waters off British Columbia. And just based, again, on the native accounts and art and so on, there's way more going on there than anything I've ever seen for Loch Ness. I mean, for example, you know, there's a lake on Vancouver Island that I visited where there are petroglyphs, so stone carvings etched into the mm-hmm. rock. And what you see there are very familiar animals to most people. There's a killer whale depicted, there's a seal depicted, there's a crab, and along the very bottom on the water's edge is this incredible sea serpent with this horse-like head and kind of a mane coming off its head, and it's exactly how it's been described, both by Native people and by dozens of people from, you know, all walks of life.
Do they say, Peter, that this creature is violent?
No. In fact, I mean, there've been some. It's really quite a remarkable thing because it's even been sighted on a beach by a lady. One of the people that we've interviewed saw the creature up on the beach.
Oh, does it have legs?
No. It just kind of slithered up, and people believe that it may in fact either go there to bear its young, or has other reasons for being up there. But again, there was a tie-in with the native people. I was up there on an unrelated project, and I'd already met this lady who told us that the creature came up on the beach. So, you know, you can decide to believe her or not. But now I'm up in a native community in halfway up British Columbia, and I point to this island, and I ask the people, well, what's that island for? And they said, well, our young people would go there traditionally. It's a vision quest. It's where you go and you experience the supernatural. And if you were really lucky as part of your vision quest, you might see the serpent on the beach. And it really gave me shivers at the time because I thought, wow, that's exactly what that woman saw. And this island has actually been, there have been other sightings by non-native people, by Westerners, white people as well in that area. So it all kind of has come together.
When they see the creature, Peter, is its head like on the sand like a snake would be, or does it lift its head up almost as if if it had legs, it would look like it could be walking around with its head up?
Well, when this lady saw it, it had its third of its body up, so it was about 15 feet in the air.
Oh my.
Looking right at her.
Oh.
Because these things are 60 to 70 feet long. And
it's bigger than an anaconda.
Oh yes, much bigger than an anaconda. Yeah, it's more in line with some of the big whales, And so what's remarkable also about the story, the Cadbrosaurus, is you've got, first of all, the best photographed cryptozoological photograph I've ever seen. Most people have seen an animal was dragged from the belly of a sperm whale in the 1930s on the Queen Charlotte Islands in British Columbia. And there was a man there with a camera, and he took photographs of it. They took the time. It was strange enough. And we actually talked to the 86-year-old dock worker who was there when they dragged it out, and he said he'd never seen anything like it. And it's continues to be a big mystery, and it's certainly the much better image than anything I've ever seen of Loch Ness.
I was going to say, how similar could it be to Nessie?
Well, it has a camel-like head. I mean, it's quite strange. It's a camel or horse-like head. And in our show, in Beyond Invention, which is airing all this June on the Science Channel, one of the episodes, actually just there, but it'll come up again towards the end of June, this cryptozoology episode. And, people have looked at it. There's two scientists have been trying to get it classified as a legitimate animal for 30 years. But some of the eyewitnesses, and they're all remarkably similar in what they describe, is nothing that swims side to side like a snake might, if you
right.
see a snake in the water. It's more like an inchworm. And it's like an accordion, like it has a series of coils that seem to expand and contract. And we have a very, very clear description in our show by a guy who was a championship scuba diver back in the day. He's older now.
Yeah, would I hate to scuba dive, Peter, and see one of those things underwater?
Yeah. And, it's an amazing thing. So we went out in our show with one of the scientists and a fellow named Jason Walton, who's spent a good part of his young life looking for this. And we went out in an oceanographic research vessel with a side scan sonar device, which is a state of the art, all with military applications. I mean, these are the devices they use to find sunken ships and submarines.
Yeah.
So when we went out, I certainly didn't expect that we would get something large, a large unexplainable blip on the sonar some 70 or 80 feet down. And, I mean, we had a skeptical captain who, you know, sees a lot of balls of fish and salmon schools and all kinds of things, and he was truly surprised.
You think you got it?
Well, I mean, it'd be great to have, you know, a living creature or a really excellent photo wrap, but what we got was evidence of something large. It was a solid as the bottom, which meant it wasn't a ball of fish, and it was moving quite quickly, and it was 60 to 70 feet long.
Oh my! Now, what about the girth of this thing? How big do you think it is that way?
I think it's roughly it's not hugely thick, but I think it could be anywhere from 4 to 6 feet around, kind of thing.
Okay, so that's pretty good size, though.
Yeah.
Pretty good size. Well, man, this planet is full of incredible creatures. And like you say, because it was included in some of the ancient work, there's got to be something to it, unless they were fantastic storytellers. But you're beginning to find proof that would back that up.
Yes, there's nothing like this anywhere else on the planet. I mean, in terms of sheer backup, volume of material, eyewitnesses account, indigenous peoples, artwork. This thing appears on the drums, on the canoes. It's in the local legends, and I was really floored when I was attending what's called a potlatch in the Pacific Northwest. It's a Indian feast and celebration and a time for the chiefs to come out and present their masks and dances. And when I walked into the room, I was almost floored because there was a huge, they have these ceremonial screens that they put up that are like curtains, really, that the dancers then come out from behind. And on the screen was a massive whale, and inside the whale was a depiction of Cadbosaurus. So
I love it.
It's exactly what they found in the, you know, the sailors, the whalers found in the Queen Charlotte Islands.
Yeah.
And it's like a confirmation of that, and it's something that the natives were obviously familiar with.
Well, one day, maybe, you'll find it, or somebody else will, and we'll get to the bottom of this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, we're going to talk with you about so many different things that are going on this planet with these incredible inventions and inventors that you've met during the filming of your most recent work, and then some of your cryptozoology work. I mean, you're wide-ranging. Do you have any specific favorite, or do you like them all, topic-wise?
Well, I was some of your listeners might remember, last year I did a film called The Real Lost World, and we went in search of Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World.
Ah, yes.
The actual 9,000-foot plateau in Venezuela from which come the legends of dinosaurs and ape men that inspired everything from Jurassic Park to King Kong. And we found some incredible things on that. And, I mean, not to mention handling an 18-foot anaconda and dinner plate-sized spiders and venomous snakes and all these sorts of things. But one of our scientists found inside a new cave system on the top of the Lost World Plateau a new form of microbial life that she was so excited she brought it to NASA. NASA has invested money into her returning, and I've now just learned in the last 2 days that she's got all the approvals she needs to go back and really spend some time and collect specimens, because it could provide evidence about how life forms on other planets in outer space.
And what kind of microbial life did she find?
Well, what she essentially found, I mean, when you go into these caves, you're over 9,000 feet up, and, you know, there's not a lot that lives up there. In fact, this is one of this place is 3.5 billion years old. And these are the oldest caves on the planet. This is where Africa and South America split apart.
Okay.
So there's species there that only exist in Africa and on this plateau in South America. So it's amazing. It's really old.
Yeah.
And inside the cave, there's not a lot of really big life, although we found some unusual crickets and some pretty strange looking critters. But what was interesting is there are stalactites. And we found out that they're not, most stalactites are formed when limestone drips off the walls. These stalactites were formed when silica-eating microbes, which has never been seen before, left residue on 300,000-year-old spider webs. So what we have are essentially living stalactites that are growing from the walls of this place that provided clues to our scientist, Hazel, to say, okay, this is something special. And she's one of the world's experts on cave biology. She's an advisor to NASA. She's appeared in IMAX films and going into caves. And so it's quite an amazing thing. So you go looking for dinosaurs, but we find something on a very small level that could provide clues to life in outer space.
She has got to be aware of what they found in Illinois about a month or so ago. Coal miners found, looking up, a tropical forest, a huge petrified tropical forest in a coal mine in Illinois.
Wow.
I mean, it's apparently during earthquakes and changing, they found this, and they think it could be 300 million years old. I mean, it's absolutely, and everything is still intact. It's all fossilized.
Yeah.
But it's there. I mean, the mysteries just continue, Peter.
Exactly. Well, coming off of, we did Sasquatch Odyssey, and then I did a series called Monster Hunters. It was really one of the first cryptozoology, maybe the first cryptozoology series, actually, in 2001, 2002. And so then, you know, I was thinking of what to do next, and I came up with this idea of, I think mad scientist has kind of a bad connotation, but
yeah.
I like the idea.
But a fascinating one.
Yeah. The idea was mad scientists, and then from that we found a whole series of amazing inventors, people that work outside the system, that maybe they've got all their money in this, maybe they've got, you know, their entire lives poured into the theories that they're trying to prove to the world.
So they believe in this.
Yes. And I think what we also wanted to do was to touch on so-called real science, but to look at individuals that are in the system but are also dreamers and amazing people getting things done that are like science fiction. And I'll just give you a little preview here. This would take us, this journey of over 24 stories around the world would take us from the laboratories of John Hutchison, who your listeners know,
yep,
the anti-gravity
work that he's done,
work, all the way to Sandia Labs, one of the top military laboratories in the United States. We got access to some amazing things. Grasshopper robots inspired by actual grasshoppers that are 8 inches high, that can leap over 5 stories and are being used to hunt Taliban in caves.
5 stories?
Yes.
All right, hold on with us, Peter. Let's come back and talk about these inventions. This is incredible. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And we will be back with our special guest tonight, Peter von Puttkamer, as we talk about some incredible inventions. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Peter. Let's talk about these inventions. And first of all, how did you go around putting together the 20 stories, the 20 inventors?
I mean, none of this would be possible without the internet these days. I mean, to do this kind of research and find people, you know, both inside and outside of mainstream science, that's what we wanted to do. And I think, you know, I mean, it kind of breaks down into maverick inventors and dreamers, people that have something that they've wanted to do all their lives. For example, we've got two two men who are chasing dreams by building their own rockets. And one's about to launch himself into space using a giant crossbow. I just read that.
How's he coming back down, by the way?
I'm not too sure.
He hasn't figured that part out yet.
But there's independent space, you know, industries popping up all over now with space tourism. We featured one of these companies in England. And then, you know, you have people that are basically within the system, and they're coming up with amazing inventions just all on their own. But essentially, I would say what it breaks down to is academic science is naturally very skeptical. They don't move ahead in great leaps and bounds. They want proof up front. They want to see all the classic, you know, experiments.
And they really don't invent, Peter, do they, the scientists?
No, often it seems like it's a hindrance to, you know, true inventors. But what is interesting is that the military is always willing to take risks. And one overriding theme, if there is one in the show, is that military science is funding a lot of the most advanced, far-out experimentation and, you know, creation of different inventions that aren't necessarily weapons, but they're delving into areas all over the place. Even as you guys have probably heard, the, you know, clairvoyance and PK abilities, these sorts of things.
Let's take a few of these inventions. Give me a few that really got you going.
Okay. Well, I think one that springs to mind is there's a company called Nexia Industries, and they're coming up with a new kind of bulletproof vest that is made up of spider webs.
Real spider webs.
Spider webs grown inside of genetically modified goats.
What?
Mm-hmm.
How? They put spiders inside of a goat?
They take the genetic material from the spider, the part of the spider that makes the web material. And apparently the process of the way spiders create webs, that is, getting proteins from their blood system, is much the way in which goats make milk, getting proteins from their blood system. So they're using the goat as a vehicle for creating a large amount of this web spun material through genetic manipulation. And the U.S. Army is involved, the Canadian Army is involved. There are compounds with dozens of these goats running around. And what's more, these fibers, a natural spider web is 40% stronger than steel. Just
I didn't know that.
Your garden variety spider web. So the idea was, is if you take these and you crisscross them, you're going to end up with something that's lighter and stronger than even Kevlar.
How many goats are they going to need to mass produce this for the military once they get going?
Well, I'm not sure of that.
I would guess a lot.
But currently, you know, we saw compounds with dozens and dozens of goats in them, and they're producing it, and they're producing the material. It's working. They're testing it for surgical applications, because you could use it basically for ligament repair. Things that were really strong yet flexible.
And how do they extract it from the goat, or does the goat pass it?
What's really amazing is they milk. It's so bizarre, right? It's like science fiction. They milk the goats, and then they have this machine which basically does what the spider's spinnerets do. The spider mixes. It's sort of like epoxy. It kind of mixes it and so that the proteins bond together, and they have a machine that's basically replicating a spider's abdomen that is creating this material. At the end of the day, it takes quite a large volume of milk to produce it. But in our show, Nexia Industries, they hold up, you know, a container with maybe 3 inches of this material in it.
Does it look like carbon fibers?
No, it's just like, it looks like epoxy glue. And then from that, they're able to spin it. And he's telling us that this material in the jar, and there's about 3 inches at the bottom of this jar, he says this is enough to make miles and miles of fiber. Because if you think of a spider...
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And so they just use it as a coating or a covering for the vest?
No, they're gonna.
The entire vest is gonna
be like a silk. You know, there's silkworms, right? Traditionally, but as we learn, you know, silkworms are basically like cattle. They're very docile and they do what they're told. Spiders are carnivores that have to go out and hunt and eat every day, so they don't work well as cows. So you can't have herds of spiders and setting them to work making up these vests. So they had to come up with a vehicle. Namely the goats, because goats produce a large volume of milk, and they already know about how to farm goats, and it's the equivalent of silkworms. So silkworms manufacture silk traditionally, and they did in China. I'm sure it's all been updated now, but I mean, that's how it was done. And then they would take the silk from the silkworm and make all, you know, wonderful material. And that's exactly what they're doing with this.
And this will stop a bullet.
Yes.
Incredible.
Again, it's not finalized yet. The company's still going great guns on this, and surgical applications and all kinds of other applications for, you know, bonding material and even something like really ultra-strong fishing line and this sort of thing. They're looking into all kinds of applications for it. So that was just one of the most amazing ones. Before the break, I was talking a little bit about the grasshopper robots. And, you know, it was important for me, like, if the inventors themselves weren't absolutely remarkable people, then what was important is that the invention that they'd come up with was absolutely remarkable.
Right.
And this was the case with Barry at Sandy Labs that we visited, and believe me, this is top secret. When we went to this, I'm actually Canadian, so I had to go through a bit of security clearance to get in there. And then there's people that follow you around, like even to the restroom. There's someone always there, standing there and watching you. You don't make any false moves. We were there for a couple of days filming a few of their amazing projects. And what I found out about was Barry Spletzer and his boss had gone out fishing one day, and they were using grasshoppers for bait. And they started talking about grasshoppers and how wonderful grasshoppers were and how they moved. And wouldn't it be cool if you could have a robot that was built
like a grasshopper.
Yeah. And it could function like a grasshopper. And then they got into an argument over Arizona grasshoppers versus New Mexico grasshoppers. And basically, they came up with this idea of a self-writing, piston-driven device. But it's much more than it's not just a piece of metal with a gas-powered piston on it. This thing... what do you call them? They're the grasshopper robots. They all kind of swarm and communicate with each other. They've got GPS in them. They've got little teeny brains in them.
How big are they?
It's about, let me see, about 8 inches high and about 8 or 9 inches around.
Okay.
And
like a big grasshopper.
And initial models, you know, didn't go that high, and then they were perfecting it to eventually come up with this idea of a small amount of gas to drive this thing, to the point where they've got the super grasshoppers, which can fly, you know, over 5 stories.
So it's propelled by gasoline or natural gas?
Gasoline.
Okay.
But what's really remarkable about them on these and the other miniature robotics that we investigated is that these things, if anyone saw the movie Minority Report, where mm-hmm. Tom Cruise is getting chased into a building and they release these little crab-like devices
yeah.
that come after him, these are like those because the application, and they've already been tested in Afghanistan when they wanted to get to Taliban in caves and so on. I mean, this was all cutting-edge, bizarre technology.
They send these little things in, and I guess they have cameras and things
they
like
have
that?
Camera, they can have cameras. They can have remote, like, sniffing devices for gases and things.
I wonder if they can have a little weapon on them.
They do. They deliver explosive payloads. And it's like Hansel and Gretel and the breadcrumbs. They hop 20 feet onto the ledge, hop into the cave, then they send a signal back to the other one. The next one hops in. Then the swarm of them hop and jump down and deliver the payload.
They don't fall over?
Well, that's the thing. They're like grasshoppers. When grasshoppers land, they kind of like fall over and then right themselves.
These things right
they
themselves.
They have a self-righting mechanism.
And so they do their thing. What's their range, Peter?
I think right now, it's just a few miles. Like,
and then they run out of the gasoline?
And then they run out. But they can actually hop along. So I had this vision sort of out of Star Wars, you know, where you have the desert guys with the guns looking down and seeing these bizarre little R2-D2 creatures hopping along the ground and then springing up into the caves and blowing up. It's definitely out there. And along with these, we discovered another project Barry was working on.
How much do these critters cost, by the way?
I'm not too sure. I actually don't know the cost.
Okay.
It may be at one of those top secret.
Probably a million bucks a piece or something like that.
I don't know if they'd be that much. I guess the intelligence hardware inside them is be the most expensive. And while we were doing this, because a lot of the research there is around chemical plume detection, we went from the grasshopper robots to the tiniest robots on the planet, autonomous. They're a quarter of an inch, and they fit on to a nickel. And they have tank treads, and they can actually sniff chemical plumes. They can have little cameras or listening devices on them. And again, the idea is you take a handful of these in a, say, hostage situation. You throw them under a door. They're small enough to go under door jams.
They're like little flybots almost.
Huh? Little flybots. They come in on silently on tank treads, and they can observe and watch and send back information.
I love it. I mean, this stuff is just... It sounds like science fiction, Peter, but it's not anymore.
No. No, it's not. And yet, you know, you don't really hear or see a lot about it. You have to really dig. And I was surprised at the amount of cooperation that we got from the military. I kept saying, isn't this like top secret or something? And it's, oh, no, we have press releases. But we were... I felt really privileged to be there because I just never heard of this.
What happens next when they sneak these in our food and we ingest them?
Well, right now, they're not that small. So, I mean, they're pretty small, but it'd be like swallowing a stack of quarters or something. I think you'd notice it.
If they get them down to the nano size, though, look
yeah.
out.
Well, that, of course, is another whole field. And, you know, there's been talk for years about miniaturization to have basically microscopic surgical robots that go into your body and hunt out disease.
Or let's say you've got clogged arteries, and they go, and they just kind of gnaw their way through.
Mm.
And then I guess you get them back the natural way.
Yeah.
Ah, now tell me about the guy who's going to arrow himself into space.
Yeah, Brian Walker. He's the rocket guy, and we did a segment we produced called Gadgets, and Gadgets covered quite a wide range from rockets to amazing electronic musical instruments at MIT, And we had robotic falcons at one point. I mean, we had all kinds of interesting stuff. But Brian Walker, the rocket guy, was a self-made millionaire who made his money on toys. He's a toy maker. And he's always wanted to launch himself into space. And when we were with him, I mean, he's got an incredible array of stuff there. He has a full-size, like human-sized gyroscope in his back, one of those that they put the astronauts on to see if they can survive.
Wheel them around.
He's got one of those in his backyard. He's got a full cosmonaut Russian spacesuit that he uses for all of his missions. When we were filming him, he had a peroxide-fueled rocket that was essentially going to launch him. He wanted to go into kind of a just touching the atmosphere, like a suborbit situation, come up and come back down. And then he wanted to open the door.
By the way, we had him on the show 5 years ago.
You did.
With Art. 5 years ago. So,
yeah.
So it's interesting to see he's still at it.
He's still, I'm surprised that he's still alive, because his plan was to parachute out of the rocket at speed, like descending back to the Earth.
But I guess he hasn't done it yet. 5 years ago, he said he was going to launch himself 30 miles straight up in a rocket.
That's right. And the last that I heard is the actual rocket plan has been put aside for the crossbow. It's a giant slingshot-like device that is sending him
up. So he's going to get into some capsule.
Yeah.
Pull it down like a crossbow.
Mm-hmm.
And fling him off into space.
Yeah.
Man, that better be a pretty big crossbow. What? How big would a crossbow like that have to be? The size of a football field?
It doesn't look that big. It's a bit disturbing, actually. It doesn't look like it could really do the job from what the models that I've seen of it.
Are some of these people, Peter, that you've highlighted, do you think some of them are just not together, that these things are hoaxes or they're delusional?
No, I don't, not at all, because this, for example, this guy, I mean, he's built some real devices that have made money and work and function, and he's kind of an engineer, and he's followed through on things and had results.
So these people are the real deal.
He is a real backyard inventor. Like, there's not that many of them, and he and John Hutchison is another one. I mean, they are creating things outside of mainstream science. They have a dream, and in John's case, he's actually found a pretty remarkable energy form that hasn't really been tapped by anyone except perhaps the military now.
Well, I'll tell you what, Peter, stay with us. We're going to be back with you in a moment. Peter's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Amazing inventions. Also, we'll talk a little bit about cars that fly, some other gadgets. Also, get into cryptozoology as well. We've talked a little bit about that. When we get to the phone call segment, in addition to your questions for Peter, those of you who are inventing weird things, it'll be your time to talk with them. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.